Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do they really know? Every week, me, Jason Carty,
and me, Stephen Cockcroft, the Beatle Brains of Ireland, go here, there and everywhere, taking a forensic deep dive into the story of the greatest band of all time, the Beatles.
Come with us every week on a magical mystery tour as we talk albums, singles, solo careers, books, films, and so much more.
Become a member of Nothing Is Real on Acast Plus today for ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more, because happiness is a warm podcast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Nothing Is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Today, we're going to focus in on another year in Beatle history. And the year we're going to look at is 1974, a year when all four Beatles are ferociously busy and interacting with each other in different ways. And it's an interesting year, isn't it, Stephen? Because we come off 1973, which is the first time when they're interacting with each other, but the balance of who's doing well and who's not doing well is kind of all over the place.
It is. I mean, they really confined their expectations. So in the run-up to 1973, beginning of 74, Ringo was having huge chart success. We talked in our Ringo episode about that album that came out in 1973, that there were three top 10 US singles there. George has Living in the Material World, which produced a number one single. Red Rose Speedway from Paul, My Love, Live and Let Die, Hell on Wheels, Mind Games, and Mind Games the single. So there's a lot going on in 1973. They're dominating the charts. They're collaborating on the Ringo album. And we're coming into 1974, which is the 10th anniversary of the Ed Sullivan Show, and is presenting Capital with an opportunity to capitalize on, I see what I did there, on that anniversary. We've had the Red album, the Blue album at the end of in 1973, so there's every expectation that they're going to continue to dominate the charts going into 74.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's full steam ahead. They're all spinning off in different directions, and as you say, you know, there's no reason to think, well, this is it now, we're in the post Fab Four universe. They're all doing their own solo thing, and they're just going to be eternally successful, all four of them, in their own way forever. But yep, in some ways, 73 is just an Indian summer. It's something that actually is a false dawn.
It is. I think if you look back, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing, and if you look back, you can see 73 as sort of peak solo Beatles, in the sense that whilst they may not all be working together, they are sparking off each other and they are influencing each other. Paul, who you would perhaps have expected to be the one to be the most successful in forging a solo career, is struggling but is starting to find his feet. John, the critical mauling of sometime in New York City in 1972 is something that really derailed his career for a while, certainly in terms of chart performance in 73. But they're all there, they're all producing material, and that sense of competition between them is still there, I think.
And it's interesting, let's talk about the record company thing for a second there, because you talked about, I find, you know, when preparing for this episode, you look at 1974, it's very much a North American kind of window that you kind of look through when you see it, because that's where a lot of them are being based, or that's where a lot of the success is being focused at. And Capitol Records in 74 launched this very curious campaign that's kind of been lost in the midst of time, which is a 10 years of the Beatles campaign. And there's 64 to 74 is how they label it. And we might think as Beatle people of, well, Beatles started in 62, or British Beatlemania was in 63, as we know. But, you know, they have this thing 64 to 74, and there's a what's curious about it is, you know, there's an advert that you can see. It's up on YouTube that they put out at the time, which features Beatles songs plus Imagine plus some Band on the Run tracks and all the rest. And it's incorporating the four Beatles as a solo entity in this Beatles capital campaign.
Yes, they're not letting go of this notion of a group. So yeah. they may be working individually, but they're still part of that group. And this follows on from, again, we touched on this in a previous episode. The reunion rumors really get going in 1973, particularly around the Ringo album, where, you know, you have three Beatles in a studio working together. Mm-hmm. And this reunion aspect just surfaces again and again.
Yeah. And I can't help but feel the Capitol are, because as part of this 10-year thing, there's a very rare box that they put out of all their albums. They start, you know, as I said, promoting all the solo albums as part of the Beatles albums. There's lots of posters and paraphernalia that goes out and around. And you can't help but feel that Capitol are also keeping an eye on the fact that the clock is ticking on some of their contracts. And there's a lot of record company work that kind of happens in 74 that's making them all have big hits.
Yes, I mean, I think this is absolutely correct, and probably the album that sort of exemplifies that is Band on the Run.
Well, let's talk about Band on the Run for a second, because in some ways, you know, I think many people would agree with me, 1974 began truly when Band on the Run came out on the Czechs Notes, 5th of December 1973. But in some ways, Band on the Run is the first bookend of that year of 1974, because even though it comes out at the tail end of 73, it certainly doesn't light up the charts when it comes out. It hits the US charts at 33 the week of Christmas, and it's not the phenomenon yet that we know. It's just yet another Paul album initially, in a way.
Yes, I think the reviews are good. Mm. But it's, as you say, it's not lighting up the charts. You know, it gets to number 9 in the UK just before Christmas, and then it drops to number 13. So you imagine that Paul must have been bitterly disappointed by that, and the record company. It's just not performing well. And with hindsight, you know, or arguably a slight rewriting of history, you know, this is suddenly the big critical commercial breakthrough album for Paul, but it didn't happen when it was released. It was a slow burn, a slow build.
It is. And well, it's kind of the thing that happens in the background of 1974, you know, because it's Paul's second album of 1973, technically, you know. But, you know, there's no preemptive single in the UK anyway from Band on the Run. In the US, though, when we get into January of 1974, Helen Wheels, which is on the US version of Band on the Run, that is almost in the top 10. So let's kind of start in January 74, and we kind of look at the charts, and, you know, Ringo is still hanging around the charts with the tracks from the Ringo album that we talked about before. Helen Wheels is about to get into the top 10. And what else is going on? This is in the US that, of course, George is off traveling again.
George is off traveling. So this is, again, another sort of peak of George's interest in Indian music. So in January, he's visiting with Ravi Shankar in Benares, and he's suggesting it to Shankar at this point that he should think about touring Europe, touring the United States, getting an orchestra together. And George, being George, throws himself into this project. He has previously set up the Material World Foundation. Yeah. And this is really the first project that's going to be undertaken by that foundation. He encourages Shankar to start writing material, and they're in Friar Park recording at George's home studio.
And what's interesting is, you know, this is the start of 74. And as we're going to find out, that tour, as it slowly unfolds throughout the year, isn't going to lead in the best directions, but it's certainly the foundations of it start in January of 74.
Well, this is it, because what's happening is George, across the year, will be putting plans together for his own tour. He wants to bring Ravi Shankar on board with that. He has formed his own record label with the idea of, you know, certainly putting out Ravi Shankar records. But there's a sense that he does, at least initially, want to build on the idea of Apple.
Yes,
this idea of you know, fostering talent and bringing in other musicians. So he's really spending that first month of the year in India.
Yeah. And still, if you look at the US charts at the start of 1974, George isn't anywhere to be seen. Photograph is falling down the charts. You're 16 by Ringo is going up the charts. Mind Game is still hanging around. And as I said, Helen Wheels is there as well. And Paul is also traveling. He's in the very exotic climes of Stockport.
Yes, yes. So George gets India and Paul gets Stockport.
Well, Stockport has its own inspirational source. We're talking about Strawberry Studios in Stockport.
Yeah. So, people hopefully will know Strawberry Studios. This is essentially 10cc's studio. I know you're a big 10cc founder, Godley and Cream.
I'm a Godley and I will take Godley and Cream over 10cc because I'm peculiar that way. But yeah, it's a Strawberry Stockport is, I don't know, is it about 30 miles from Manchester or so? It's in the north of England.
Yeah.
And it's Strawberry Studios was set up in the late 60s by Eric Stewart and Peter Tattersall, who'd worked with Billy J. Kramer's and the Dacosas. And Eric Stewart had made a name for himself. He had taken over as the lead singer of Wayne Fontana and the Mindbenders when Wayne Fontana left. And he kind of took his pop star money and opened the studio. And Graham Goldman joined as an investor. And then the house band was Graham Goldman, Eric Stewart, and then Godley and Cream were knocking around as well. And so 10cc had grown out of this studio. And Paul is in the Strawberry Studios in Stockport because he's working on the McGear album.
Yeah. And I think, again, I think this is an album that we've touched on before. This
if you're playing Nothing Is Real Bingo, you can tick off the McGear album.
You can tick off the McGear album. this is, I think we both love this album.
Yes.
You know, this is just a sensational album.
But it kind of does, the appeal of Strawberry Studios is that it seemed to have a great reputation for pop, really, this kind of very contemporary pop in the early 70s. So 10cc would be a part of that. The McGear album's a part of that. Neil Sedaka did a bunch of really interesting kind of comeback albums with backed by 10cc in the same studio at the time. So and Paul is kind of in and out of Strawberry Studios, which is kind of odd for him to be. It's an odd part of the world for him to be hanging around in.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've read interviews with Mike McGear. And this really came out of Paul saying to him, so, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, how are you putting food on the table sort of thing? And you know, would you like to make an album? So Paul has really takes the start of the year and off and on across the next few months is really devoting a lot of his time towards what it's odd. I mean, they obviously had expectations or ambitions that this was going to be a sort of a commercially successful album.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's extremely weird album.
Well, again, I wonder, you know, and as I said, I love the album, but it came out in Warners and it kind of got a big push from Warners and promotional films and all the rest. And with record company shenanigans, you know, Warners were in play for Paul himself at some point in the mid 70s. And it might have been you know, part of that politicking was to, you know, look after the McGear album. Look what we did for Mike.
Yeah. There's a Mike McGear has a very interesting book. I think it's called Family Album, and he describes the promotional tour, which is not a musical tour. It's just him really going around radio stations with Derek Taylor.
Yes.
In the US, you know, it sounds like he had a ball, but I'm not quite sure how productive it was, but. We've probably floated this theory before that this is a sort of a Paul gets to cut loose here.
Yes.
You know, he's not burdened by the commercial expectations of producing a new Wings album or a new Paul McCartney album. And there's a bit of kind of messing around and just he's a lot freer in what he's doing.
He's also recording because obviously Mike McCartney was in one of the three members of the Scaffold. And Paul's also working with the Scaffold at this time, who are kind of back in action. They've been inactive and they're back again, and they've a hit, a kind of a another kind of freak hit single in 1974 with Liverpool Lou, and Paul produces that.
Yeah, I always thought Liverpool Lou was a sort of traditional
so did Paul
song, and so did Paul, but it was actually written by, it's an Irish song, all the best songs are
all
Irish
songs.
Written by Dominic Bain, who is the brother of Brendan Bain. And as you say, Paul thought it was a traditional song, and he put his name on it,
yeah,
or, you know, traditional arranged by Paul McCartney. There was a bit of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing.
And, a tap on the shoulder, so to speak.
And the later pressings were correctly credited. So if you find a copy of that single, it, you know, it was a big hit single, so there's a lot of them kicking around, but what you're looking for is the one with the Paul McCartney writing credit.
And then you can retire.
And then you can retire.
And
or, you can gift it to us.
Send it to P.O. Box, Nothing Is Real.
Yeah.
The B-side is a strange thing, which I have to admit I don't recall listening to until getting ready for recording this podcast, which is, it's called, what's it called, 10 Years After on Strawberry Jam. And it's written by Paul and Linda.
Yeah.
And it's just this kind of odd groove and Liverpool chat and all the rest.
It's just essentially an instrumental with sort of conversation in the background. You know, it's exactly the sort of thing that Paul would be doing on McCartney 2.
Yeah,
you know, if you think like Check My Machine and Secret Friend and those odd little in studio experimental things. He's doing it here. You know, this is where he's sort of experimenting with.
If you do listen to it, it sounds like the guitar is going to slip into the theme tune to Coronation Street at any point in time. That's
well, they were near Manchester.
Exactly.
Can we do our, can I mention the Liverpool Lou connection with Yoko?
Oh yeah. What is that?
Yoko chose this song, not Scaffold's version, but chose this song on Desert Island Discs in 2007 because John used to sing it to Sean as a lullaby.
Oh,
so there you go.
That's nice.
Connections everywhere.
So as the month progresses, Helen Wheels gets into the US top 10. It hits number 12 in the UK. Ringo gets to number one with You're 16, and Paul is on Ringo's You're 16, as we mentioned on the Ringo album episode. So they're all going quite well, and then as is normal, February follows on from January, and we're getting back into this realm of Beatle reunion rumors.
Yeah, so in February, Melody Maker just announces that there is going to be a Beatles reunion, and the interesting point here is that no one is officially denying this.
Yeah,
although Ringo is the one. You think of Ringo as being the sort of affable one that would, you know, come out to play with any of the other three.
Yeah.
He actually says, well, I'm not keen on a Beatles reunion.
Oh.
And if you think about it, at the time, why would he be? I mean, he is arguably the most successful, commercially, the most successful of the four of them.
Yes.
You know, he's certainly outperforming John. And I think it's around this time that John famously sends him a telegram or a note saying, any chance you could write me a hit? You know, so and he's just about to release Oh My My, which is the third single, which will give him another
top 10 hit.
Yeah.
What's interesting is, you know, as February goes on, it leads back to this thing of Band on the Run being in the background. Helen Wheels starts to drop down the US charts. And on the way down the charts, it meets Jet coming up the charts. So I think it drops down to about 37. Jet comes in at 69 on the 9th of February. And so Jet starts a 6-week ascendancy into the top 10. And so what that starts to do is that starts to provoke the album itself slowly into the US top 10 as well. And Band on the Run starts to get this momentum in February.
Yeah. So as we said at the beginning, this is a slow build.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you sort of read about Band on the Run is this is one of the first Beatles solo albums to have a very dedicated marketing campaign. So
yeah.
Capital are really throwing a lot at this, and it's well thought out, this idea of putting Helen Wheels, which has been a hit in America. You know, Paul sort of reluctantly accedes to that request. So there is a strategy here. There is a marketing campaign, and this is really the first time that we start to see this. We'll see it later in the year, but this with other releases, this is really the first time that Capital are doing this.
And it's interesting because the strategy is, and it hasn't really, certainly wouldn't have been a Beatles strategy, and it hasn't really happened with the solos. It's mine the album for singles.
Yes.
And so, you know, Paul has said in interviews, oh, there was a guy in Capital who said, I think Jet's a single. And, you know, the single was actively worked. And, you know, the record company kind of they realize it's a good song. They realize they have a hit, and they realize that the conditions are right, and they are getting it up the US charts week on week. But it is this interesting slow burn, you know.
And again, thinking back, I mean, Paul is the one that has post-Beatles stuck with this idea of standalone singles up to this point.
Yeah.
And Hell on Wheels was clearly intended to be a standalone single. And, you know, he'll do that occasionally going forward. But you know, this seems to be the point at which, again, you know, he's looking for commercial success as well as critical success. And so, mining albums for singles, it's the way forward.
The way forward.
And what's interesting is, you know, this talk about the reunion, it also feeds in over into the, you know, the High Court shenanigans, because the Beatles still aren't clear of, you know, suing each other and everybody within a 2-foot radius. And Paul says, you know, there's a High Court appointment of an Apple receiver, isn't that right, to help wind up the company? And Paul says, as soon as we get all that sorted out, you know, we can get together and do something. You know, that's the kind of vibe, which is, you know, a line he played for many, 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 many years.
Yeah, I mean, I think consistently this is what used to sort of particularly annoy George, you know, that he always used to say, you know, when Paul has something to sell, he'll tap into that, those reunion rumors. But no one, as I say, no one was denying it at this stage. Yeah. They were sort of letting that rumor float out there, and it's difficult at this remove, you know, 50 years on, where, you know, particularly post 1980, where you knew that was never going to happen. This was only 3 years after the split.
Yeah,
it's still and so fresh. There was every possibility. I mean, I remember 78, 79, thinking there is a, you know, they're going to get back together. I mean, they will get back together.
Yeah,
and but this was such a real possibility and such a tantalizing possibility. And as I say, 73, they had dominated the chart.
Yep. And Paul gets nominated for an Oscar in February 74 for Live and Let Die, and he doesn't win. Boo.
No.
That's...
Well, I have to say, yeah, Marvin Hamlisch, The Way We Were, I'd rather have Live and Let Die.
I wasn't sure what side of the fence you were going to come down there. So I thought you were going to say, you know, he lost to the better song.
He's no Marvin Hamlisch.
So then we get into March, and at this point, George's tour, that, you know, the seeds that have been sown in January, his US, his North American tour, gets confirmed by Apple. And actually, this is a, you know, we take it for granted now with, you know, Paul's been on the road so much, but this was the first proper tour by a solo Beatle that gets announced.
Yeah, this is going to be the big American tour. You know, no Beatle has done a tour there, so they haven't done a tour since 1966. John has done a couple of one-off concerts. We had Bangladesh, but this is a full-blown tour. Yeah. And again, this is the early 70s. This is the start of this sort of arena style touring. I mean, this is really in its infancy at this stage.
Well, the other tours that are announced at this point and that kind of evolve in 1974, the two big tours, and we'll come back to them maybe a bit later on, are Bob Dylan, and he's touring with the band, and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And they both do these massive tours. And in some ways, they are era defining tours. They set up the next 40 to 50 years of rock star touring in a way.
Yeah, this is the template that we're still using.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking at indoor arenas, we're looking at outdoor football stadiums. This is the template.
Yeah, and you know, if, correct me if I'm wrong, Dylan hadn't toured properly in about 8 years. He had done Isle of Wight and a few things, but so Dylan's on a tour with the band. And you know, the question is, are you going to give them something new or not really? People, this is the tour as looking back, play the hits. We don't really want the new stuff. This is where all this comes from in a way.
It is. I mean, you know, this is the start of the hits tour by those big sort of top tier artists. It's also, I have to say, the start of Bob Dylan's willful recasting of his own material. So it's sort of, well, of course I'm going to play the songs you want to hear, I'm just not going to play them the way you want to hear them.
Yes.
So you know, he does the acoustic set and that's fine, but he's if you listen to Before the Flood, it's a fantastically powerful album, and he is just howling out the lyrics. The vocals are amazing, but it is a completely new sort of approach.
Yeah, and Crosby, Stills and Nash are doing these kind of 3 or 4 hour long shows. And what's interesting about these tours is, and the Stones' tours, you could say, are kind of evolving into that as well. And they've been kind of on back on the road about 2 years. It's this notion where the show is less about the band and it's more about the audience's night out in a way. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. It starts to become, particularly with the Stones, it's a spectacle. Mm. And you know, when you go to see Crosby, Stills and Nash, you know you're going to get a couple of kind of hippy dippy songs from Graham Nash, you're going to get some kind of jazzy folk from David Crosby, and then you're going to get the guitar workouts from Neil Young and Stephen Stills. And they're dividing up the show. You've got an acoustic set, they're absolutely delivering what the audience want.
Yeah.
I mean, there is an expectation there, and they're fueling that expectation, and the audiences are now settling into this notion that this is what you're going to get.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And so George is announcing a tour in this kind of environment. And there might be an expectation maybe that he's going to supply what people want. So that's a tour for later in the year. Also happening is the last non-Beatle related Apple single comes out by Badfinger, Apple of My Eye, which I think is from their album Ass. And that's a bit of a kind of a slow, it's not their last album, but it's a bit of a slow end for Badfinger and Apple.
It is. It's you know, Apple of My Eye is a sort of regretful look back at their relationship with the Beatles and with the label, and it's a long, slow decline. Mm. Not necessarily in the quality of the music, but in terms of Badfinger's potential and Badfinger's commercial success. This was, again, 1972 it was originally begun, but it was delayed because of production problems. Badfinger had sort of been slightly diverted as well. They turn up on the Imagine, some of them turn up on the Imagine album. They were there at the Bangladesh concert. Todd Rundgren was brought in, produced 2 songs. I think everybody falls out with Todd when he's trying to produce their records.
Been known to happen, yeah.
And then Chris Thomas, who was working as an engineer, so Chris Thomas of White Album, Sex Pistols, Back to the Egg, am I right in saying Chris
Thomas?
Yeah,
Back to the Egg.
So this is a very sort of a mixed bag, but this really represents the end of Apple as a label.
Yeah.
You know, it's now the home of the four Beatles who are seeing out their own contracts.
So we haven't spoken much so far in 1974 about John Lennon. And in March 1974, that finds John out in Los Angeles. He's living with May Pang. So he's separated from Yoko. And he's moves into a rented beach house in LA.
So
this is a notorious kind of house in a way.
This is the sort of the riot house. So John is out there, really part of his separation from Yoko. He's put a lot of miles between himself and New York. He is just at the beginning of 74, coming off the back of the initial sessions for the Rock and Roll album. I don't think we'll kind of go into it. There's a whole episode, I think, to be dealt with about his relationship with Phil Spector. But those sessions began in October 73, ended in December 73, when Phil Spector ran off with the tapes.
Yeah.
So that entire project has sort of run into the sand, and John is at a bit of a loose end. One of the things that I hadn't known was that he actually meets with Paul and Linda at this point. So Paul and Linda are in LA for the Oscars, and John is hanging out at the Oscars. So I wasn't aware that that had been a meeting.
Yeah, and there's no photographic evidence of that that we know.
I've not seen anything. No.
But obviously, John was commiserating with Paul about the whole Live and Let Die Marvin Hamlish disaster.
I would say
crying on each other's
shoulders. Very upset, probably, that Paul didn't win an Oscar.
But then this sets up, you know, what's, you know, perhaps more famous about this beach house and 1974, which is when Paul goes to visit John in the beach house. And John is, the main thing he's doing at the time is he's working on Harry Nilsson's Pussycats album. Isn't that right?
That's it. So, you know, he having no project of his own, and on the basis that he seems to have decided, you know, things are getting out of hand, you know, so we've got John, we've got Ringo, you've got Harry Nilsson, you've got Keith Moon, all of these people are hanging around LA. Nothing is getting done. They're all having a very good time, I imagine. So John undertakes to work with Harry Nilsson on this album. And yeah, it's that same sort of rotating cast of characters that we had on the Ringo album.
Yeah.
Who are all hanging out in LA and all sort of working on this. And it's during one of these sessions that Paul and Linda just happened to drop by Burbank Studios.
And tell me this. First of all, in terms of the Pussycats album, let me ask you, do you like the Pussycats album?
I do like the Pussycats album.
Okay.
I think if you take the best songs off the Pussycats album, and it's a mixture of originals and sort of old 50s rock and roll covers. Take the best tracks off that, the best tracks off Walls and Bridges, a few tracks off Rock and Roll. Mm. It's a great album.
But that's not what happened.
I think about half of Pussycats is really good. The rest is not so good.
Yeah, I love Nilsson. I always find Pussycats hard to love. And this is also the milieu in where John and Harry Nilsson are hanging out, and they're thrown out at the Troubadour Club for heckling the Smothers Brothers. And they're generally high on life. Is that a fair thing to say?
High on life and Brandy Alexander seems to be the...
But here's... Then we get to the end of March, and, you know, Paul and John have obviously had some kind of avenue of, you know, reconnection.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, on the 28th of March, Paul turns up at this beach house come recording site and decides to just be part of the gang. And this leads to what we now know is this Toot and a Snore in 74 bootleg is the recording that you can hear of this today. Yeah. But it's quite on paper, it sounds amazing.
Yeah, well, you've got John, you've got Paul, you've got Linda, you've got Stevie Wonder, Harry Nilsson, Jesse Ed Davis, Bobby Keys from the Stones, and the producer at Burbank Studios, Ed Freeman, all sort of involved in this impromptu jam. And as you say, on paper, this should be wonderful. But what it is an insight into how chaotic and unproductive the whole sort of sessions around that time were, that everyone is either drunk or, you know, high as a kite. You can hear at one point, John offering Stevie Wonder some cocaine, asking for some cocaine. You know, they're all fiddling around with microphones. The most fascinating thing for me is the fact that Paul is not pushing himself forward. He's not trying to sort of take control, or he's not trying to drive the session. You would think, Paul's instinct would be to marshal the troops and try and produce something. And I think the sense here is Paul knows that this is not going to produce any magic.
Yeah.
And this is not what he wants the reunion to be.
Well, Ringo has already left the building, which is interesting. He'd already headed off for the night. So we could have had John, Paul, and Ringo, at which point, you know, because what Paul does on the recording is he goes, sits on Ringo's drums and just starts drumming, because that's what you want. Not really, is Paul being the drummer, but he's trying to, he is doing a little bit of, fall in, get stuff started, but it's really...
Yeah, well, I mean, at one point, John says, "Did anybody else but me on a mic?" And Paul sort of goes, "Yo, you know, this kind of, I'm over here behind the drum kit, you know, and the kind of the follow-up to that is that the next day Ringo comes into the studio and immediately says, who's been messing with my drum kit? Because Paul has obviously altered the stool or the settings or whatever. And Paul was here, and he goes, McCartney always messes up my drum. So this is kind of long suffering
Ringo. You know, it's odd. Imagine if, you know, Carnival of Light style, we hadn't heard this tape, but we knew it existed. We would be falling. We'd be so excited about, oh my God, what does this tape sound like? And I'm assuming many people listening to the podcast have heard this tape. You can go off to YouTube and find it now. One of the people there, as we said, there was May Pang, who wasn't behind an instrument, but she was taking photos. And some of the photos we have of these few days when Paul is hanging around are the last shots we have of John and Paul together.
Yes, yes. So she has a couple, she's two books. My favorite title book is Instamatic Karma.
I see what she did there.
But she not only are there photographs, but she sort of gives a written description. And it's one of those, you know, hello, John, said Paul. How are you, Paul? He replied softly. Fine, how about you? You know, it's all very sort of rose-tinted. And she says, you know, John and Paul played together. It sounded fantastic. They made joyous music together that night. That was the only time John and Paul, backed by Stevie Wonder and Harry Nilsson, played together after the breakup. And you think, I don't know what she was listening to, but it's not what you and I are listening to.
When Paul was asked in 1997, does he remember the session? He said, hazy, for a number of reasons, which is quite coy.
Yeah.
But Paul and Linda hang around this beach house for a couple of days.
Yeah, they're kind of hanging around for a couple of days, and May Pang is there, as you say, and there's snaps of Paul, I think, with his little moustache.
His little moustache,
Sort of around the pool, and that is the last photograph taken of John and Paul together. And they're just sort of they are snaps. They're sort of Polaroids and just a little Instamatic camera. But so on the 31st of March, Paul and Linda go to the beach house, and this is supposedly the point at which Paul passes on a message from Yoko saying, you know, she'd like to get back together, and he's giving sort of advice to John that he should try and win her back. And the other interesting thing that happens on the 31st of March is that Phil Spector, who is holding the session tapes for Rock and Roll, is in a really bad car crash. The weird thing is, you know, I think we can say Spector was a bit of a nut before the car crash.
Do we have to run that through our lawyers, I wonder? I don't think so.
I think that's a fair comment. But this seems to make him even worse.
Literally, he was in a car crash and he lost his hair.
Exactly. So this is one of his biographers says, he was very seriously injured. The police that arrived thought he was dead. And it's after this he starts wearing these kind of outlandish wigs, supposedly, according to his biography, because of the scarring for the, like, literally 300 stitches, there. But the weird thing is, at this point, Phil Spector was lying low, hiding from Lennon, and had put the rumor about that he was dead.
Right.
And then he nearly was dead, you know? So, but it's just another very odd relationship period with those relationships.
Well, there's another odd thing that happens on the 31st of March, which is, and I find this amazing. John Lennon attends the American Film Institute tribute to Jimmy Cagney, and he's attending this thing with Mick Jagger, and it's a television event. You can watch it on YouTube, and it's hosted by Frank Sinatra.
All that talent, you know?
Oh my God. And
it was a weird 70s were weird.
70s were weird. Well, what's interesting is Jimmy Cagney at that time was 73. And we think of,
he was an old man.
He was an old man, and now we look at Jagger, who's in his 70s, and Paul in his 70s, and all the rest. And then April 1st, I think, is Paul and Linda's last visit to the beach house, which is where one of my favorite ever things happens when Harry Nilsson, I think I might have even said this on the podcast before, walks up to Paul.
You can tell the story. This is a good story.
Well, no, Harry Nilsson walks up to Paul and says, "Hey, Paul, do you want some of this?" And Paul says, "What is it?" And Harry says, "It's angel dust." And Paul says, "What's that?" And Harry says, "It's horse tranquilizer." And Paul says, "No, I'm fine." And that, and Harry goes off and enjoys his day. This is the kind of the last John and Paul hanging out moments. Yeah. But what's interesting is that week of April the 1st is that Jet has been working its way up the charts. It's now a top 10 hit. So when Paul's hanging around with John, Jet is at number 7 in the US and the UK. And
I bet you John was really pleased by that.
I don't know, was John paying attention to the charts, but it's interesting. And Paul and Linda hang around LA for another little while, and they call over to Brian Wilson's house.
Yes, this is a very sad story. Paul and Linda, supposedly the 4th of April, are turned away from Brian's house. They can't get in, but they know he's there because they can hear him inside sobbing.
Jeez, that's sad.
And you think this is a kind of, although I have a friend that I was talking to about this, and he said possibly he was crying because he'd heard Keith Moon's recently recorded version of Don't Worry Baby. So Keith Moon is part of this circle. And again, you know, because everybody else is recording an album, Keith Moon decides to record a solo album. So I don't know if you've heard Two Sides of the Moon.
I have not heard Two Sides. I'm pretty certain I made an attempt one day on the streaming services, and then after about a minute realized life's too short.
Well, what I would recommend is that it was 10 songs long. This will give you an idea of the quality. It was 10 songs long. It came out a few years ago with the original Mal Evans mixes.
Oh yeah.
And some bonus tracks. There are 41 bonus tracks.
Oh Lord.
So for all the completists out there, you can
dig that out. Well, you talk about Keith Moon. He's hanging out with Ringo Starr, and in April 1974, they appear on this radio program with Mark Volman and Howard Kalin, also known as Flo and Eddie. And it's a bit of a, again, high-spirited affair.
It's a high-spirited affair. And again, I think you've talked about this, at the time, this is all hijinks. People are getting it. But looking back, you can see this is a kind of tragic start of a tragic decline for Keith, for Ringo.
Yeah.
But yeah, they appear on this live TV show. I'd be tactful how I say this. Ringo was very drunk and dropped the F-bomb 15 times in a 90-second period while they were attempting to interview him. They caused the program to overrun by 40 minutes. Complaints were made, and literally everybody involved got sacked. But you know, what larks.
Poor Ringo. For a man who could only eat beans, he certainly was able to imbibe an awful lot of other things.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. But, you know, Ringo's other great big triumph of April 1974 is everyone's favorite film, Son of Dracula.
Yes. Let's talk about Son of Dracula. Let's do a whole episode on Son of Dracula. So for people that don't know, this is a rock and roll vampire movie starring Harry Nilsson as Count Down and Ringo as the magician Merlin. It's as good as it sounds.
And it's an Apple film.
It's
bankrolled by Apple.
Bankrolled by Apple. Well, supposedly bankrolled to the tune of about $800,000 by Ringo.
Right.
But I watched this recently. It's available on YouTube. It has never surprisingly got a DVD release. And again, maybe one day we'll do a whole episode on Son of Dracula. But it is a terrible movie. But the only sort of interesting aspect that would make me want to watch it is Ringo called in Graham Chapman and Douglas Adams from Hitchhiker's Guide to rewrite a whole new script that would be dubbed onto the existing films. So it was like the existing dialogue was so bad. And I don't know what stage that got to, but if that was Ringo, Harry Nilsson, Graham Chapman, and there is another alternative dialogue soundtrack, I would like to see. I would like to hear that. It's a bit like the Woody Allen film, What's Up, Tiger Lily?
Yeah. That's a Well, the last time I saw that film, I thought it was funny. I don't know how politically correct it is in 2020. Yeah, yeah. 30 years ago, it seemed funny to me.
Yeah, but you kind of think, you know, an alternative DVD with an alternative soundtrack, that would be that'd be great.
It was an interesting time for Python as well, because Cleese had left Monty Python temporarily, and Graham Chapman's partner became Douglas Adams, a pre-Hitchhiker's Guide Douglas Adams. So it's a curious time for them as well. And there was a soundtrack for that, but the soundtrack has kind of been lost to the midst of time, because instead it's, you know, we just know the songs. Most of the songs are from the Nielsen albums, Nielsen, Schmielsen, and Son of Schmielsen. But the cover of Son of Schmielsen gives you an idea of the high caliber of acting that went into Son of Dracula.
Yes, he's dressed as Dracula on the cover of that album. Now, Ringo apparently didn't know that when he cast him.
Oh, really?
So,
I assumed kind of station to station style. It was just a freeze frame from the movie, no?
No. Okay. It was done before the movie. And when they discovered this, or when Ringo discovered this, there's a scene in the movie. I'm now about to give you a 30-minute exposition of Son of Dracula. There's a scene where Nielsen, it's quite an effective kind of walking through, you know, the rain-soaked streets of London.
Yes.
And he stops outside a record shop, and his own record is in the window. So they have a big sort of Nielsen display. There was one new song, Daybreak, which was recorded back in 72. But again, Harry Nilsson, Ringo Starr, Klaus Voormann, Peter Frampton, George Harrison. So again, it's this again the same sort of rotating cast of everybody hanging out together.
And there's a nice score attached to it from
Paul Buckmaster.
That's it, Elton John's arranger in those early days.
And if you do see this album, it's the only album ever released on the Rapple.
Oh yeah, that's a crossover label, isn't it?
It's a crossover label between RCA and Apple. And the front is a sort of not quite gatefold sleeve. It's a picture of Nielsen and sort of a cape that folds out. I mean, there was a lot went into this. You know, there was clearly a lot of serious money thrown at the film and at this soundtrack, and it was a disaster. Ringo said they only showed it in towns with one cinema
to force people.
If there was another cinema, people would go to whatever was on in the other cinema. So, anyway, there we go.
And the same month, we're still in April 74, John vacates the beach house in LA. He relocates to New York. He's still with May Pang, though. He hasn't gone back to Yoko yet.
He's still with May.
But it kind of belies this notion of, you know, the lost weekend. Because, you know, once he goes back to New York, he is kind of getting rid of all the drugs and alcohol. He's kind of cleaning up his act and he's sorting himself out and all of that.
Yes, I mean, this is really the sort of start of a sort of little burst of creativity following that Lost Weekend. The Lost Weekend is described as a sort of 18-month period, but really it's
not that long.
It's not that long. It's quite a short period. It's the rock and roll sessions. It's you know, four or five months. I suppose that would be long enough if you were drunk every day. But
might have felt like 18 months.
Yeah, it felt like 18 months.
And the other thing that's happening in April 74 is that Paul is auditioning drummers for Wings, and he ends up with Jeff Britton, who's probably Wings' shortest-lived member, who's a karate black belt.
Yes, and completely drug free.
Yes, that'll work out well.
The only person in this rotating cast that is drug free. supposedly he auditioned Mitch Mitchell.
Yeah.
Which I can't see. Can you Mitch Mitchell drumming on?
I can't really see that. But
you gave me the answer.
But it's interesting that Paul didn't, you know, and we've touched on this before, that, you know, Paul didn't go down the super route. Supergroup route. He could have, you know, put a couple of names together, or you think of his Run Devil Run band, you know, which was kind of quite famous names for a short period of time. But he was trying to, you know, his heart was in trying to do something organic in bringing up people who were new.
Yeah, he just wanted to be in a band, man.
That's all he did.
Up and down the motorway in a little transit van.
Just, I mean, like the old.
genuinely, you're not supposed to laugh at Paul. I genuinely think that this is what he was after on those early Wings tours, up and down the motorway, that he was harking back to the way the Beatles had been in the early 60s. And you think, but you're a superstar. You're Paul McCartney. You can't. And you haven't known these people for half a decade. You know, you don't have that relationship.
And then, we get to the end of April and John produces this kind of mysterious song for Mick Jagger. I don't think I've heard this, called Please Don't Ever Change.
Yeah, this is an odd thing. This is in the Keith Badman book.
Yeah.
And I'd never heard this mentioned before. And initially when they were talking about, this Jagger session at the Record Plant East, I thought, oh, that'll be too many cooks spoil the broth or spoil the soup, which was also produced by Lennon, but previously back in LA. So I've never heard this version, Please Don't Ever Change. I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, never saw the light of day. If anybody has it, again, add that to the list of things you're sending.
And so when we get to May is officially when George launches Dark Horse Records. And do Splinter come out at that point, or is that later in the year?
That starts around this period. So
okay.
George, I think, goes into this with the idea that he'll be fostering talent. He'll be supporting artists. I've read that he and Ringo briefly considered buying Apple at this point.
Okay.
Like buying the other two out and just taking it forward and maybe trying to take it back to what the original intention had been. But he sort of decided, no, it would be easier to sort of start his own label. Yeah. George is very critical of Apple about the money that was spent, and it was sort of tries to disassociate himself a little bit by saying, oh, it was Paul and John, it was really their idea. But he was probably the most involved of all of them in terms of collaborations and production, and he seems genuinely to have wanted to do that.
Yeah. And what's also happening at this time is finally in the US, Band on the Run gets to number one, sort of mid to late April into May. And as Jet drops down the charts, Band on the Run appears at the bottom of the charts. So it's this cycle of single promotion. So Jet drops to 27, Band on the Run appears at 68, right at the end of April. And they throughout May, Jet drops out, Band on the Run goes up. And by the end of May, Band on the Run is in the top 10 in the US.
Yeah. On its way to number one.
To number one. It gets to number one in June, which is where we should probably go to. Yeah, it gets to number one in June in the US. And Wings also gets Jimmy McCullough, who joins officially in 1972. And, or in June 1974, excuse me. Yeah. And the other thing that happens in June is that John starts to get his act together and he starts to work on Walls and Bridges. And maybe that might be a good place to pause, because 1974, we're halfway through and it's starting to get very, very interesting. But originally, you can see already that it's getting quite congested with Beatle traffic.
Yes, I mean, I think this is a logical point where we've looked at what's been happening specifically with John around LA. This is now John moving into a genuinely creative period, and is probably a good starting point for part two.
Yeah, all of them get recording during the summer of 74, and we'll talk about where they end up in the next half of 1974. Thanks again for listening to us. We're available in all the usual places. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod. We're on Facebook at the Nothing Is Real Facebook group. Ask Stephen if you can get in there. And please subscribe if you haven't already. Leave a nice review if you feel like doing that. But otherwise, we'll see you next time. And for Nothing Is Real, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll see you soon. Thanks. Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.